Hi, this is Susan Glasser. Welcome back to the Global Politico. Our guest this week is Hugh Hewitt. He's the conservative commentator, radio show host, MSNBC host, columnist for the Washington Post, columnist for various other outlets, basically a multi-platform conservative commentator. I've been wanting to have Hugh on the show for a long time. I think he's one of the most incisive Republican voices out there today. He's both a critic of President Trump while steering clear of being a never-Trumper. And his views in particular on foreign policy in the age of Trump and what it means for conservatives are something I've followed closely for a long time. So I'm delighted that he was our guest this week on the Global Politico. We've had a huge shakeup over the last couple weeks. Call it a purge, if you like. Just call it a shakeup, call it a reorg. But you have been out there saying you think this is going to be a good thing when it comes to the appointment of John Bolton as National Security Advisor, when it comes to Mike Pompeo as the new Secretary of State. Why are you so confident this is going to lead to a better national security team for President Trump?
Well, thank you for having me, Susan. I am impressed with this selection because it reminds me of late Reagan era breadth and depth of competence. So this week I was at the Hoover Institution, got to meet George Shultz for the first time, even though I'd worked in the Reagan White House. I was a briefcase carrying kid, so I never got to talk to the sainted ones like George Shultz. And so I do, though, know that era pretty well. Secretary Shultz was at State. Secretary Baker was at Treasury. Howard Baker was the chief of staff. Bob Gates was the head of the CIA. Over at Defense, you had Carlucci. So by the end of the Reagan era, of course, you had Vice President George H.W. Bush and you had Attorney General Edwin Meese. By the end of the Reagan presidency, they had a well-oiled foreign policy machine. But at the beginning of the Reagan presidency, we had Al Haig and an assassination attempt and a lot of chaos and a great deal of disorientation. So I always kind of look at the first year of a presidency as a shakedown cruise, and the president, no matter which party and no matter which decade, has to find people with whom he is comfortable, or she in the future, working, and get them installed. It's clear he's very comfortable with CIA Director Mike Pompeo. Director Pompeo gave me an interview out at Langley for MSNBC in late June of last year. I think it was his first interview. And at that time, he told me on the record, it's on tape, that he would go 4 or 5 times a week to the White House and spent a lot of face time with the president, and in every meeting, North Korea came up. And so I'm not surprised that he has asked the director to become the secretary. I am hopeful that Shultz's competence accompanies him there. I think it will. I've talked to Mike Pompeo for a long time because he's an Orange County, California boy, and so I have a natural connection with him because I've lived out in Orange County for nearly 30 years. And he is a friend of my dear friend John Campbell in Congress, and that's how we were introduced. And I was told by John when he retired, he was a regular guest of mine on the radio, have Pompeo on. He's the smartest guy in Congress. And sure enough, he was the number one in his West Point class. So I think raw intelligence is there. A lot of competence, like Shultz, who went ashore at Peleliu. Mike Pompeo has been in battle. Shultz, he's held other jobs before he became Secretary of State, though not as many as George Shultz, is the most experienced Secretary of State ever, I think.
I'm still reeling from your disclosure. You never met George Shultz before. This is incredible.
Well, it's one of those things where when you're a briefcase carrying 30-year-old lawyer in the White House, you don't go up and tap the Secretary of State on the shoulder and say, I'd like to say hello, Mr. Secretary. I got to know General Meese pretty well and General William Fred Smith because I worked for him. And Fred Fielding and Dick Houser, but not the state people. They're different from the political people and the lawyers, and they don't much like us.
By the way, is that how you got to know John Bolton in the White House counsel's office?
No, I got to know John Bolton after the Reagan years because, again, he was the assistant attorney general for the civil division, which was a vaunted post. That was his first, advise and consent post. I was a special assistant doing FISA work for Bill Smith and Ed Meese, so I was not – I got to go to the staff meetings and sit on the wall and say nothing. Those were the years in which 30-year-olds were expected to take notes, not have opinions.
Not so, run the world.
Yeah. So in any event, Bolton I got to know when the ambassador after the UN, And when he began doing a lot of media, we would cross paths in green rooms. We became friends in the political campaigns that we would both cover, and he would come out to Los Angeles, and I would host him for dinner, have him on the radio quite a lot. And he's very good friends with one of my law partners, Robert C. O'Brien, who had served with him as at the special representative of the UN, and Rick Grinnell, good friend of mine, longtime spokesman for John Bolton. So I just got to know him in the last decade, not in the years of Reagan.
But you have a very different take on John Bolton than even many other Republicans, even many other staunch conservatives who have criticized him in the days since his appointment came out and said, well, he's neither temperamentally nor policy-wise a good fit for President Trump. You think that's overblown?
Very. I base this on a couple of things. First, I've been with him quite a lot, and temperamentally, he's as gracious, charming, and good-humored as anyone I know. I don't put – there's only one level of graciousness. It's complete, and he's got it. And I go back to – professionally, his memoir, Surrender, is Not an Option. I think I did a three-hour interview with him, at least a two-hour interview with him about his book, which I read very, very closely. And like Don Rumsfeld, he – and Dick Cheney, his memoir is of such precision, depth, and footnoted complexity that you realize you're dealing with a truly class A intellect. And I believe a lot that intelligence in diplomacy matters more than in any other of the fields. You can wing it in a few other areas. Just eloquence will get you by in a few courts of law, but you'd better know foreign policy inside out. You better know who are the players. And every time I've talked to Ambassador Bolton, I can never come up with a question he can't answer at length and in depth. And he is not unaware of everyone in like the Politburo of every minor country. Ask him sometime who's running, Belarus, and he'll know. It's a great capacity for information, which will make him, I think, a great combination of the Scowcroft and Kissinger model. And those are the two models. There's an article out today from the Chicago Foreign Relations Council on, is he going to be Scowcroft model or is he going to be Kissinger model? I think he'll do them both. And
the difference, right, is his president. And that's the question I have, is what kind of a fit do you think he's going to be with the president? And more broadly, do you see this shakeup on Trump's foreign policy team? Is it about making an ideological or a policy shift, or is it really more about getting people he's more personally comfortable with?
I think it's the latter, Susan. I think he is an intuitive president. He's not someone who came to the office with a great grand strategy of how the world was going to work. I like to point out to people, Nixon was planning the opening to China at least from 66 forward and wrote an article in Foreign Policy in 67 about it. That's not Donald Trump, right? And Richard Nixon did nothing except think about Russia and China for 30 years and spend a long career getting ready to be president while Donald Trump was building skyscrapers and running reality television. So he needs around him a team in whom he has confidence, and he has got it with, I've described it as Mike Pompeo will be his right arm and Jim Mattis will be his left hook, and his corner man will be Bolton and Kelly. And I gather Gina Haspel as well. I don't know anything about her other than the near unanimous praise that has come from inside of the agency by longtime professionals about her competence and courage as well as her professionalism. So I'm just going to assume that Director Pompeo recommended her and that she's had a lot of interactions with the president, but I don't know that. I don't know her. I've never met her. Have you ever met her?
No, I haven't. We talked about this the other day on the radio. She's a little known insider, career insider in the agency. I think it's going to be fascinating to see whether she can get confirmed.
That is. I will talk on my MSNBC show with the three Hill reporters about that, because Mike Pompeo is widely regarded as an easy confirmation, though he'll take some licks in the hearings. But eventually the red state Democrats will vote for him. I can't imagine Doe Donnelly not voting for him or Joe Manchin not voting for him. These red state Democrats are up for reelection, not voting for Mike Pompeo, who has great reviews at the CIA. But she presents an interesting dilemma as well for Democrats and for some Republicans like John McCain. The circumstances surrounding her posting to Thailand when it was a rendition site will be of interest to everyone during those hearings. I don't know what they are. They're secret, but they're not going to be secret for long. We're going to find out a lot about the enhanced interrogation program and what did she know and when did she know it and what did she do and when did she do it. And I don't think they would nominate her if it was a problem. I could be wrong. we've nominated people before on both parties that have had flaws come out in the process, but I don't think that's her.
Well, you also – there's a real question about what is the process that they're following for these nominations. Just the other day, you had the president nominating the White House physician for a position in the cabinet as the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, apparently without an interview, without what looks like a regular order process of much kind. So there is a little bit of a question on how much vetting, how much planning was done for that nomination at the CIA. But let's go back to the question of – the Trump foreign policy, and you know, you think these folks will be a better fit for him. Why? Because he likes them? Because their loyalty is a word that gets bandied about a lot these days. What does that mean in the context of Trump and foreign policy for you?
I think it means argue it out fiercely in front of him, and when a decision is made, stick to what the decision is. Don't try and undo it. I don't believe H.R. McMaster did any backbiting or any kind of undermining of presidential decision-making. I do believe that some members of the NSC would undermine the president, as was evidenced by the leak of the memo, the briefing paper, about Vladimir Putin. Don't congratulate him. Well, that's a staff recommendation. It's up to the president of the United States whether or not to use the language, and that it got leaked was an obvious attempt to embarrass the president. I don't believe that's General McMaster doing that. He's far too savvy a strategist to try and embarrass his boss that way. It's not good for our relationship with Russia. It's not good for anything. But somebody did it. And so I think he's looking for John Bolton to bring a grand new group of people into the National Security Council who can be counted on to be discreet and supportive of whatever the decision is. But what I have noted about the first year of the Trump presidency, I've been critical of some parts of it, very supportive of others. I think Scott Pruitt's doing a great job, and that's why the left is throwing stones at him every day. I think that Rick Perry's doing a great job. That's why he's in for attacks. It's the ones who aren't doing very well that we don't see much about. But the one thing I've heard consistently is the president puts everybody into the room. They argue it out, sometimes repeatedly, at length, and then he makes a decision he expects the team to execute.
I think on foreign policy, one of the challenges, though, is that we're still somewhat confused about what Trump's actual foreign policy is on many of these key areas. And just this week, we had a few good examples that I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. For example, he said, I think it was just yesterday, well, we're going to be getting out of Syria very soon, which is a direct contradiction of something that Secretary Mattis had said and our policy to remain there indefinitely. On Russia, obviously, there remain the question marks, the gap between our official policy and President Trump's rhetoric. On South Korea, we made a trade agreement, and then Trump said, well, actually, maybe we'll hold off on that until I make my North Korea deal. So there's a lot of confusion that I still have about what is the president's foreign policy orientation on some of these key issues.
His foreign policy is not of a strategy that anyone's laid out, right? It's contingent on events. He did not arrive in the White House intending to launch cruise missiles at Syria. Then Syria used chemical weapons, and he asked for options, and I believe he took the option that General Mattis, Secretary of Defense Mattis, suggested to him among the options. No one planned on that. It evolved. He wanted to improve relations with Russia, but then Russia used a chemical agent in Salisbury and basically sickened 130 Britons and attacked an ex-GRU agent against the rules of the intelligence game who had been exchanged for a KGB FSB person working in the United States and a few others. And so nothing was as it's expected. He's gotten along better with China than we expected. And who would have thought North Korea would be thinking about sitting down with the United States a year into the Trump presidency after, 24 years of frustration, beginning with Jimmy Carter's unauthorized trip to the Korean Peninsula as Bill Clinton was preparing for possibly war. He doesn't have a strategy. He didn't have a plan to go with this recipe of events that have been thrown up, but he's dealing with it on a contingent basis, case by case. I think he would still like to go back and have some kind of a rapprochement with Russia. And Admiral Stavridis was my guest today. And I asked him, what do you think we should do with Russia? And he said, well, I would like to have 60 days of everyone just calming down and not doing anything. Let's not fire off any more ICBMs. Let's not close any more consulates. Let's not expel any more. And certainly let's not poison anyone with weapons of mass destruction on NATO countries. And then let's see where we cooperate, where we can, and confront where we have to. I thought that, of course, the Admiral is one of the most eloquent observers of foreign affairs in the world. And so that's a great summation. Cooperate where we can, confront where we have to. And I would say that pretty much defines the Trump presidency today.
Somebody said to me that they thought the comparison between John Bolton and Trump when it came to foreign policy is that what they have in common is a form of muscular unilateralism. I'm wondering what you think of that.
John Bolton is very much for a muscular American foreign policy in the Reagan mold. I think, as I said to you on the radio the other day, he is a Reagan conservative, full stop. He's not a neocon. He wasn't ever a Democrat. He came out of Yale and Yale Law School as a fully formed Reaganaut, and was happy to work as a Reaganaut. And I went back to his UN confirmation battle when he was nominated to be the ambassador and did not get successfully confirmed and was eventually appointed via the recess power. He got a letter from Cap Weinberger and 60 other Reagan-era diplomats endorsing him as being the real deal conservative, peace through strength, 600-ship Reagan conservative. And that's what I think appeals to a lot of us about having John Bolton in the White House. We don't know that there were many people who believed in the vast defense buildup that we need, similar to the defense buildup that President Reagan had to implement following the hollowing out years of Jimmy Carter. We've been through those hollowing out years again because of the sequestration. That was a bipartisan blunder, by the way. That wasn't just on President Obama. That was agreed to by the Republicans, and it was a disaster for the Pentagon. So before we can actually confront some of the greater challenges around the world, we have to rebuild the fleet. I mean, the fleet's at 280 or less ships, as opposed to Reagan's nearly 600. We have to replace, people used to laugh at me during the campaign, I'd bring up the Ohio-class submarine aging out, but it is. So we tested a Trident missile in response, I think, to the Russian Satan II, I think they're calling it, last week. And I thought to myself, there you have it. We're back to needing SSBMs right away. And the Columbia class is 15 years away from being in the water.
But so, Hugh, I totally get why you and others who identify with sort of muscular Reaganism would be cheering for the John Bolton appointment. But is Donald Trump a Ronald Reagan conservative? There's not a lot of evidence of that in his prior history.
I would point to the Philadelphia shipyard speech during the campaign, which he pledged to a 350-ship Navy, a pledge that he actually incrementally increased in his speech on the Gerald Ford to a 355-ship Navy, and a 12-carrier group, possibly 13-carrier group Navy, to the idea that he would build two supercarriers at the same time, to the idea that the F-35's got to get squared up, and in the meantime, we're going to buy more F-18s, and to the actual line item addition of a line for the Columbia class. And I haven't seen as much of it as I'd like to see, but he is clearly a believer in the great fleet approach to international power. And I'm a big believer in sea power because we are a sea power. And I think he told Putin, I saw a report, I haven't seen it confirmed out of the White House yet, on the phone that, hey, if you want to have an arms race, we can have an arms race and I'll win. And he always makes it personal, right? When you learn how to listen to Trump.
I will win.
And Reagan would have said, and we will destroy you or something, or you'll end up on the ash heap of history. But Donald Trump says, I will win. That's quasi-Reagan-esque, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, Reagan is the guy who's your hero. Do you really want to compare him to that? I mean, it's strange.
I'm not comparing him. I said it's quasi-Reagan-esque in that he's not going to get beaten by the Russians in the way that Reagan said, you know, ash heap of history. And yes, I greatly admire the president, Reagan, for his diplomacy, but so too HW, so too W. And they operated from positions of strength vis-a-vis their adversaries. President Trump is not, because of 8 years of President Obama. And I think we should return to that. He inherited a mess. And Lindsey Graham, who I saw, you know, box with Donald Trump throughout the entire campaign, and I would never have thought they'd be friends, right? Never.
Right.
Never fails to remind me that he inherited a mess at every level on every continent because we tried for 8 years. What happens when we withdraw American power from the world? When we go soft power exclusively and we cut our defense budget and we antagonize our allies like Israel and we seek to empower longstanding foes like China and Russia. We end up with Russia in Syria, aligned with Iran and Hezbollah, with an axis leading from Tehran to the sea. It was predictable, but evidently we had to try to prove it to ourselves again.
So what, I mean, there's clearly been an enormous amount of turnover and, you know, feeling your way. You could call it the first year problem, which you pointed out does happen in many White Houses. If so, it's an unusually extraordinarily high level of turnover. But still, you could say it's part of settling in. Do you feel that there's a real risk of Trump falling out with this new set of advisors as well, given his personality and background?
Yeah, I do think there is a risk. I hope it is minimized by the enduring presence of Pompeo is not new to the administration
right.
in the way that Bolton is. He's a continuation in a bigger job. Secretary Mattis is still there. Against all reporting of 2 months ago, John Kelly is still there.
Mm-hmm.
And and Gina Haspel represents continuity, not change at the CIA. It's understaffed at State. In fact, when Secretary Pompeo steps in, he'll have, I believe, 9 advising consent positions to fill, which will give him the opportunity to bring in a bench that Rex Tillerson never really thought he needed. I never understood why. I don't know Mr. Tillerson. I'm glad he was willing to serve, but I don't think he had the skill set for the State Department. Very few people do. I think Mike Pompeo does. And in the way that Schultz replaced Haig, I'm hoping Pompeo replaces Tillerson, and you go from dysfunctional relationship between the White House and Foggy Bottom to a very close, almost seamless wielding of authority. Because when George Shultz spoke, everybody knew he was speaking for Reagan. And I think it could be said that when Hillary Clinton spoke, she was speaking for President Obama. And you've got to have that relationship, or it doesn't work in any kind of international forum or any kind of negotiation.
Well, that's right. You wrote that the Tillerson firing was necessary for national security. Is that what you meant?
Yes. I meant that you can't have a Secretary of State wandering around the world that no foreign leader believes is listened to by the president. Because it would be like me representing Politico to the world. I have no agency. And so the agency that lawyers refer to was formal but not real. And I'd rather have real and formal agency. And I think we'll get that with the Secretary of State designate Pompeo.
So what quickly is your feeling telling you about North Korea and the upcoming summit? Is it going to happen? Is John Bolton, he's written publicly, talked about the need for a potential military strike on North Korea, very skeptical that negotiations could produce anything. Does that color the summit on the front end?
I believe that what this is about is a face-to-face meeting where the president, hopefully flanked by Secretary of State Pompeo, confirmed, and Secretary of Defense Mattis, communicates to the North Korean delegation that the maximum pressure campaign will continue unless and until denuclearization is achieved and verification accomplished in deep ways. If you read, if the audience listens to this and wants to get one book, go get Surrender is Not an Option. John Bolton knows everything about the North Korean deal of 1994, its many flaws, and how the North Koreans operate. He'll insist upon a verification that is not like the Joint Comprehensive Agreement regarding Iran, which is no verification on military bases. He's not going to buy that. And I think this summit is going to be about, we really mean this. This is not the Clinton years. This is not the Bush years. This is not the Obama years. This is the Reagan years. And you can't have these. And we're not going to let you do banking, which is our primary confrontation means with them right now. Cut them off from international finance. And maybe an embargo if things go south. But hopefully that trip to Beijing by Kim Jong-un had gotten the same kind of message from President Xi. We only know on the other side. And I would like to remind people, Reykjavik, I'm thinking about Schultz a lot because I just saw him. That was a disaster, right? It was a failure.
Right.
And 2.5 years later, the Soviet Union dissolved. So it might not appear at first glance that whatever happens when the summit occurs or doesn't occur, I think it will occur. And I've seen some stuff that indicate in Sweden. The immediate result will not be the final result. We won't know for a long time whether or not it worked.
Well, that's a good reminder because I do think people are now treating this as if it's sort of a football game, you know, and there's a first quarter and a second quarter, but it's highly unlikely to play out that way. I do agree with you. So stepping back a little bit, what do you make of President Trump's continued refusal to talk in critical terms about President Putin? Even this, you talked about the leak, of which was a very damaging leak and a surprising one, of his internal talking points telling him do not congratulate President Putin, which he apparently then did congratulate President Putin for winning another six-year term as Russia's leader. Why do you think President Trump does not ever criticize President Putin? You have this almost bifurcated foreign policy right now with his administration increasingly talking tough. We're now in an escalating war, not only of words, but of actual expulsions of diplomats. And yet you still have, as you said, a president who clearly hasn't let go of this dream of a grand deal with Russia that he himself would orchestrate.
Yeah, grand bargain. And that's what Nixon arrived in office wanting. He, before anyone knew it, before it was a glimmer in any reporter's eye, Nixon was planning to go to Beijing, and Dr. Kissinger was making, I think, his first trip was in 71, 3 years into the presidency, in anticipation of the 72 visit. And it was a surprise, and that's the kind of thing that Donald Trump would love to pull off, right? And right now, the emerging powers, the People's Republic of China, and President Xi is president for life under the amendments of the Chinese Constitution, the way that they do business. So what did Nixon do? He split the Soviets at the time and the Chinese, and that worked to our great advantage. So if you were thinking that anything could be done, you'd want Putin to come our way and lean in against Xi to sort of reverse the dynamic of 71, 72, 73. And when Admiral Stavridis said today, cooperate where you can, that would be useful. It'd also be useful to have the Russians stop butchering children in Syria. It would be also useful to have the Russians stop killing their expatriates in London and sickening 130 people along the way and attacking our election. And they're not really redeemable in many people's eyes. And I remember Dick Cheney telling me and telling many people, it's not original to me, when I looked into his eyes, I saw a KGB colonel, and that's Putin. And I don't think that's going to change. And maybe Donald Trump has figured that out, or maybe he's always known that, but was at least leaving the door open to the way developers do. I'm not really going to close the door on anyone because another deal might come along. And I'll make sure I put this in.
But he's burned his bridges with so many other people, but never, ever with Putin.
No, he hasn't. And because that's the biggest developer. I keep telling people Donald Trump is a combination of a real estate developer and a movie producer. And real estate developers, for whom I worked for three decades, never, ever burn bridges that they can't rebuild because they might have to do a deal with the guy they were screaming at or the gal they were screaming at 30 minutes ago. They might have to go swap land parcels or co-finance or double down on risk. They're very, who do I need to be in whatever room I'm in with whomever I am meeting, mm-hmm. People, because they're driven by the permit and the building, not by anything else. And movie producers are always in rough cut and always in edit, and his tweets are his director's notes. I just finished writing a book review for the Washington Post, which will appear in a few days, on a new book, which I can't discuss because it's embargoed until it comes out. But I just found myself at the end saying he's a producer meets developer in the Oval Office. It's sometimes not that complicated.
Well, I like to know that our decoder, at least, is giving us some helpful things. So what has surprised you as you have tried to decode Trump? I feel like the last few weeks have been particularly tumultuous, even by his standards. Has there been anything that's surprised you about where we are right now?
The most surprising thing is the stability of his relationship with General Mattis, mm-hmm. Who I have had the pleasure of hearing talk but never interview. Because he won't be interviewed. He refuses to be interviewed. And I've made every approach and tried to land that plane in 10 different airplanes and 10 different airfields, and it won't happen. He just doesn't like the media much, and especially maybe just doesn't like me, and that's fine. But
no, it's not you. He won't talk to anybody.
Okay, so it's not just me. I'm glad to hear that. My feelings are. But Mattis, when I did hear him give a speech in a small group to a group of media fellows at Hoover a couple of years back, is not diplomatic in private. He's a very blunt, forceful, tough as nails Marine, and with a strategic worldview. And I didn't know that that was going to last, but it has. In fact, I think it's deepened. And I love the fact that General Mattis invited John Bolton to the Pentagon and greeted him on the steps. So he came out to see him. Admiral Stavridis also thought that was significant.
Oh, yeah.
And joked with him that, I've heard you were the devil, so I wanted to meet you. I think that is terrific. That's Marine humor. I know a lot of Marines. And I think that it represents a very hopeful sign that this new bench, or the second line, as they would say in hockey, has come onto the ice, and it's going to work much better than the first time, the first year.
You are an optimist at heart, which maybe is why you admire Ronald Reagan so much, right? He was probably
there's a pony in there somewhere, Susan.
Right, right.
Yep, there's a pony in there somewhere. Oh, one other thing that's most surprising: he moved Jerusalem. He didn't move Jerusalem. He moved the American position on Jerusalem.
Right. He moved the embassy there, and that's going to be open soon, actually.
Yeah, and I know you were a correspondent there and a bureau chief for a long time, and no one believed he was actually going to do that, because all presidents say they're going to do it, and then none of them do it. And Donald Trump's advisor, Kellyanne Conway, came on my show early in the presidency, said, oh, no, he's going to do it. And that was mocked and ridiculed, and sure enough, he did it. And so I think if he makes a commitment, he follows through on that commitment. And when the prime minister of Israel, Netanyahu, said, do it, he said, okay, I made that deal. I'm going to follow through. And they're friends. I think that helps. But that's a surprising thing, because I just thought no American president would ever come around to that.
Why do you think the Republicans on the Hill up until now have been very, very averse to publicly criticizing him? There's just such a small handful of folks who've come out consistently disagreeing with him.
Because he's delivering on the commitments he made. He delivered on the Supreme Court justice. He's delivered on the appeals court justices. He delivered on the tax bill. He was willing to sign it. He was willing to sign anything they could pass on Obamacare. They couldn't pass anything. And so if you're a Republican in Congress who's the chairman of a committee, you like Donald Trump. Because if you can get a bill through your committee and onto the floor and over to the other house and back, in fact, it happened this week. Rob Portman got the SESTA Act passed on Friday. It's on the president's desk. And it is a great, it's a great thing to have a president who will sign bills. It's unified government, unified Republican government. And the Republicans enjoyed that for a grand total of, I think, 9 months, 8 months in the last 30 years, where the president would just be able to sign whatever came over, was willing to do that. And so I'm trying to think the early Bush until Jeffords jumped was a period of time when they could get things passed. And that might be it. Am I missing something? Am I misremembering something? Maybe in early 2005 and 6, but very quickly it broke down because of the presidential campaign. Katrina is the year of horribles for the Republican Party with 2005. George,
yes, that was not
W.
a good
Bush.
Year.
Yeah, he bet everything on Social Security reform. The Democrats wouldn't move. Harry Reid held the Democrat minority together and filibustered it. Then the end of death, Terry Schiavo meltdown, and then Katrina, by which point all of Bush's political capital was gone. So about 9 months in 2005, they had a window and nothing got done. So Republicans are passing laws and they have a chance of getting to his desk. That's a great thing. And they control the courts for the first time in 8 years, and that's a wonderful thing.
What do you think happens this fall? Will they lose the House?
I'm pessimistic about the House. I'm also optimistic about the Senate. And the Senate map is so overwhelmingly favorable to Republicans. I think they have a very good shot of beating Manchin in West Virginia, Donnelly in Indiana. Claire McCaskill is, a dead senator walking when it comes to reelection. I think John Tester's got trouble, even though he polls better than the other red state Democrats. I think Rick Scott's a formidable candidate if he gets in. There are five to seven races, which I would put in the lean Republican category, and one Republican seat that's in danger, Dean Heller's, and one that's on the 50-50 line, which is Jeff Flake's open seat, which Martha McSally will win if Congressman McSally is nominated. I don't think you beat an A-10 combat pilot, the first woman A-10 combat pilot ever. And Kristen Sinema is a very formidable congresswoman, but she hard left in Arizona as a center-right state. Just saw Doug Ducey last week. He's got the best response to school violence and the threat of gun violence in the United States going. He's a great candidate to lead their ticket. So I'm an optimist about governors. I'm an optimist about senators. But the House is about what happened 3 weeks before. And I remember 2006, John Boehner was in my radio studio in California, swore to me that summer, we'll never lose the House. Gerrymandering. It will never happen. And we lost the House. And do you remember Mark Foley?
Of course.
Yep. There's a Foley out there somewhere. That's what I just think the Democrats are. There were so many. Your colleague at Politico, Tim Alberta.
Yes.
At the early part of the year told me there's a list of 24 members of Congress of both parties who have scandal in their past. And I think that list was not overestimated. We've only seen 3 or 4 of them. And I remember that people sat on the Foley scandal until it was election season. So it's going to be wild.
Well, that's a fair prediction for a wild election year. So we're almost
way out there on a limb.
Exactly. It's 50-50. Chances are either way. But, okay, you're keeping the Reagan flame alive. Can the Reagan flame survive Donald Trump? What comes after?
Sure. Dick Cheney, I'll quote the vice president again. You only get 8 years. And that was in his second term. Sometimes you only get 4 years. We blink and a presidency is gone. I'm 62. I've been doing this since 1976, campaigning for Ford in Massachusetts. You blink and a presidency is gone. You think that a president makes a lasting impact. And in fact, Ronald Reagan's 600-ship Navy is down to 272. When someone who worked in his White House, me, is still old enough to be, still young enough to be working and commentating. So we always overestimate the significance of our time and underestimate the speed with which it passes.
You're a great reader, Hugh. What are you reading to help make sense of this moment in time?
Well, I just finished Sea Power by Stavridis, and I think that is probably a significant book for everyone to read and absorb. I'm going to tackle History of Gibraltar next because I've always been fascinated by the Royal Navy and its role in the history of it sitting out on the desk out here. And then I've got some thrillers to run through, which is my candy, my secret vice is to read Dan Silva after Brad Thor after Alex Berenson. Just keep them coming, and then I'm happy.
A little escapism is not a bad thing, although these days with the poisoning in Salisbury, as you pointed out, it's almost like real life is imitating a novel that has a pretty elaborate plot some days.
Gabriel Allon has been predictive. He's the central character in the Daniel Silver series. He's a Mossad agent, and now he's the head of Mossad. Has been predictive of many, many things over the course of the 15 or 16 Allon novels that exist.
All right. Well, you heard it here first, then. Take your escape in fiction this spring break, folks. And Hugh Hewitt is our guest this week on the Global Politico. Hugh, thank you so much.
Susan, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks again to all our listeners at the Global Politico as well. Thank you.